brought to you by the Fetzer Institute, helping to build a spiritual foundation for a loving world. Welcome, everybody, to the Wonder and Awe podcast, A Journey into the Soul. My special guest today is Anna Sun, who is an associate professor of religious studies at Duke University. She earned her PhD in sociology from Princeton and her BA from Berkeley. Sun is a scholar of Confucianism in particular and of contemporary Chinese religious life in general. Her research interests include the 19th century production of knowledge about Chinese religions, the development of global Confucianism in the 21st century, comparative ritual theory, and theoretical issues underlying the social scientific study of religion. Welcome, Anna, to our podcast.
Thank you so much, Louis, for having me. It's such a pleasure and honor to be here. I've been admiring your work for a long time.
Oh, thank you. So I know you're trained as a sociologist of religion, and your goal is to look at religion in a really clear way, which I think is a really challenging task. I'm curious, what inspired you to go on this path?
I have always been interested in what makes life meaningful for people, for myself, for my family, for my friends, for people I meet on the street. And I know religion has been a big part of contemporary life, no matter how scientifically advanced our society becomes. Temples are not going away. In fact, in my research, I see people doing very traditional rituals everywhere throughout the world, in Asia, in Europe, in North America. And trained as a sociologist, I feel that it is both my privilege and my duty to try to observe religious life objectively, or as objectively as I can, and try to understand it. I think my motto for my own work is to do justice to how people live a meaningful life through religious and spiritual engagements.
You know, I did see an interview, and you talked about the practice of religion in China, and you used the phrase multi-ritualism. What do you mean by that?
When we speak of, say, multiculturalism, we speak of someone who, or society, may have multiple cultures existing at once. So people can be multilingual, bilingual, multilingual. People may be multicultural. Multi-ritualism speaks to the fact that in much of the world today, and especially in East Asia, where I focus my research, people practice rituals that come from different religious traditions. They would go to different temples, different sacred sites for different purposes at different times of the year, or sometimes on the same day. It's not uncommon for someone, say, at the end of the Chinese Lunar New Year to say prayers in a Buddhist temple, a Taoist temple, or if they have access to a Confucius temple, to a Confucius temple as well.
I think that's so beautiful because, you know, in my inner soul, I always feel that we shouldn't all believe the same thing, that we should always be asking the questions like, what is life? What is the great mystery? What is God? And obviously, there's been a lot of strife in history where one side wants the other side to believe what they believe. And there's a lot of war attributed to that. So I love what you're saying, that in East Asia, you can blend all these different, you know, rituals or values, which I think seems to be the core. I remember I was in Bali, and they have like a mixture of Hindu, Buddhist, animism, I guess, right? Belief in nature. And it's all blended, and then there's a tremendous amount of harmony and no religious strife or battles about it.
Absolutely. And I love your example of Bali. I just returned there in January after a short period of doing field work there. It's an absolutely amazing religious site if you are looking for religion in Bali. So I was invited by Chinese, Balinese, Indonesian Confucians. There is a vibrant, small but vibrant Confucian community in Bali. And I was invited to visit their temple where they actually have a weekly service. And I was also shown a Chinese temple inside a Buddhist temple. So my Confucian Balinese friends, in fact, prayed to the deities, Chinese deities, both Buddhist and Taoist deities, inside this small temple, inside a large Hindu temple complex.
So why do you think that in these Eastern religions, it seems that they really focus on values, like, you know, helping your community, being kind, being compassionate, more than this monotheistic, we have to all believe the same thing, the same way. I'm just curious, like, how do you think, why did that diverge? Or what are the origins from East versus West?
I think if you look at the teachings of all religions, from polytheistic to monotheistic religions, so from Hinduism to Buddhism, Confucianism, to Christianity, Islam, Judaism, the ethics are all, in the end, about loving, compassion, about care for one another. That said, you're also right that we've seen more conflicts in monotheistic traditions. So there is this wonderful Egyptologist scholar, Young Asman, who has been writing about the price, what he calls the price of monotheism. So monotheism went through this period from being inclusive to exclusive. So in the form of exclusive monotheism, we say there's only one true God and there's only one true religion. And that excludes the other traditions, and the other traditions may also seem threatening.
It also seems not compassionate. If that's the core of all religions, and you're excluding the other, and we all know how we're going through a tremendous amount of political discord with, you know, in our country, with, you know, this idea of the other, whether you're left, right, and it's creating a tremendous amount of hatred. It seems like that value of exclusion is not a spiritual, you know, path to be on.
Oh, indeed. In fact, at Duke, I teach an undergraduate class called Knowledge of the Other through an understanding of Asian religions. So Asian religions are often treated as the other in many different ways. And we have this, what I call the monotheistic assumption, that assume religion should be monotheistic and anything else may be primitive or just about magic or superstition. So we don't give other religions their due. We otherize religions that are not similar to ours, that have different ways of being religious. And we have a lot of misunderstandings about this, what you call the other religions, rightly, because we are not open-hearted enough, I think, very often, to take religions that are very different from our own Western monotheistic assumptions seriously enough. Teaching this class is that I see this tremendous desire amongst my students to try to not treat religions that are different from our own in the West as other.
So you mentioned, you know, you work with young people because you're teaching in the university. Organized religion is on the decline. And I'm curious, why do you think the younger generation is tuning out?
So this is an issue that has been central to the sociological study of religion in the States as well as in actually much of the world today. So we have this, what we call the not religious, but spiritual generation. So according to the Pew Research Center, about 25 to 30% of people under 30 think of themselves as not belonging to a religion, but spiritual. They wish to be able to engage with other religious traditions. They wish to understand other religious values on their own terms, not mm-hmm. through the religion they perhaps grew up with. And I think mostly they also want to be open to religious and spiritual possibilities. They are not turning away from what's often called spiritual practices. They are interested in religious values. They are interested in religious practices. They are fascinated by the possibility that you may be able to combine different religious practices and beliefs together to forge your own religious or spiritual identity.
I think it's beautiful. I feel like in my life's journey, looking at nature, I think what I've learned is always to have a sense of wonder and an open perspective on everything, and looking and valuing every creature, whether it's a hummingbird, a bee, or a redwood tree, and trying to look at their life from their point of view in order to be able to tap into, you know, what is real. And maybe what is real is a spiritual journey, because I think Mother Nature is a spiritual guide for how life works. You know, we've only been here for a couple of seconds on the planet, the human species, Homo sapien, and life's been evolving for a very long time and working really well in harmony. And, you know, we all know today that there's a lot of environmental degradation, so we're not really living in harmony the way other cultures have in the past with the environment. I always think it's a beautiful blueprint to how to live your life, A, to survive. But more importantly, a lot of it does talk about cooperation, about nurturing, about community, about connection, about, you know, letting life flourish, which sounds like a religion to me, or a spiritual practice.
Absolutely. And I love how you describe how we should live our lives on Earth, this great privilege to be living on our planet, extraordinarily beautiful planet, and how we should work together to nourish it rather than to destroy it. I think your work really shows us the extraordinary beauty and extraordinary power of nature. There's a long tradition in Asian poetry focusing on nature as a path towards spiritual awakening. And of course, there's a long tradition in the West as well, from Wordsworth to Blake, and of course, all the way to your work.
Well, I visited Japan, and I thought that, I mean, they especially, I think, really nurture like flowers, nature, their art is very respective and reverent to nature. Is that true in Japan? Maybe you think maybe more than China, out of curiosity, or is it all of Asia?
I would venture to say it's all of Asia. You see this great attention paid to nature, to the earth, to the environment. But I think modern China, especially contemporary China, with its rapid modernization, industrialization, a lot of these values have been lost, or at least have been forgotten or pushed aside. But I'm very happy to see that there are many environmental activists working in China today, trying to bring our attention back to nurturing nature rather than simply focusing on economic expansion. And many of these activists draw from Confucian, Taoist, Buddhist sources.
So what is the reality now in China with the communist government? I mean, did they officially say, you know, religion is forbidden? And how do the people react to that? So what is the actual dynamic?
To answer your question about contemporary China, I may have to go back a bit into history. China was a country with many imperial dynasties for 2,000 years. The last Chinese dynasty was the Qing dynasty from 1644 to 1911. And after 1911, China had a republic. So before the fall or before the end of the Qing dynasty, Confucianism was the state ideology, both socially, culturally, and politically and ritually. Even though Buddhism and Taoism were very powerful forces in society, and they were practiced by people for different purposes and very often together. So a Chinese person in imperial China would very likely to be following Confucian rituals and Buddhist and Taoist rituals at once. So that's what the multi-ritualism we're speaking of. After the end of the Qing dynasty, China went through this painful period of modernization. China nearly became a colonized country by what's often referred to as the Western powers. So China was sometimes referred to as half colonized. So there was this urgent need to modernize. So religion was seen as a force that was holding China back, part of the quote-unquote feudal heritage of Chinese society. So in order to be powerful, to be modern, we must leave religion behind. So there was this general anti-religion sentiment amongst Chinese intellectuals. But China became a socialist state in 1949 and a secular state. So religion was not considered important. And during the Cultural Revolution from 1966 to 1976, religion was in fact brutally repressed. So many temples were destroyed. Clergy from different religious professionals from different traditions were imprisoned or worse. We could see this tenure of really brutal destruction of religious traditions in China. But what's important for us to remember is that Chinese religious traditions are very long, very strong, and this period was really a few minutes in the long history of China. Religion was not destroyed, in fact, but they went underground. And it came back up slowly but surely after the end of the Cultural Revolution, after the death of Mao. And during the reform years of the 1980s and 90s, a lot of traditional practices became openly became visible again in Chinese society. And the most important revival of those rituals is a revival of ancestral rituals. So the revival of traditional rituals from Confucian to Buddhist to Taoist really became, I think, a kind of renaissance of religious life, for people both in rural China and urban China. And my research focuses on urban China. So I have been working with a Pew Research Center on survey questions for Southeast Asia and East Asia in order to get a better sense of the religious landscape in those places. It is very difficult to ask questions about religion, to see how religious people are, because the Chinese, or for that matter, the Japanese, they don't have the exclusive identity we find, say, in American society. So if I ask my students, what is your religion? They may say, I'm A or B or C, or have no religion. It's not a difficult question. It is a very complex question to ask a Chinese person because there's no initiation ritual for being a Confucian. You don't have a baptism that tells you you are now a Confucian. By the way, when I ask my students, what makes you a Christian? They gave all kinds of wonderful answers, you know, beliefs and practices. They often forget it's a baptism. There is a ritual that actually marks the moment we become a Christian. But there isn't such a moment that marks you as a Confucian in the Confucian tradition today. And the majority of Buddhists in China who practice regularly, very often very devout, who do not actually officially convert to Buddhism. That is kind of a step reserved to the most devout Buddhists. So a very, very small percentage of the Chinese practitioners of Buddhists have officially converted. But based on different surveys, we may say anywhere between 15 to 20% of the Chinese do Buddhist practices regularly. The same goes for Taoist practitioners. So in one of the Chinese white papers on religion, the Buddhist population is estimated as, you'll be surprised by this, 50,000. Well, the one survey data number I can give you that gives you a glimpse of how religious the Chinese people are is the number of people who practice ancestral rituals every year. 68% of the Chinese conduct ancestral rituals at least once in the past year. A follow-up survey in 2016 showed that that number is closer to 75%, and people often practice those rituals multiple times a year. So if you look at religious identity, about 25% of the Chinese say they have a religious identity. They are Christians or Muslims, or they are Buddhists. Mm-hmm. But if you look at practice, about 75% of the Chinese practice religious rituals, often multiple rituals.
Wow. Well, thank you. I mean, it's really great to hear the history and how it evolved so that we in the West can have a better understanding of half the population on the planet. I mean, make these assumptions, you know, and as you said, even considering them as the other. So again, as an academic and as a professor, is there a difference between studying, you know, religion or studying spiritual practices?
That's such a great question. I've been thinking about this question for about 10 years. And a few years ago, this question led me into a collaboration with two colleagues, Situating Spirituality, Context, Practice, Power, in which we invite more than a dozen of scholars who study spirituality in different parts of the world to tell us what is spirituality in the context of your research, and how spiritual practices are being conducted. So my own contribution to this volume, besides being a co-editor, is to think about the relationship between the concept of religion and the concept of spirituality. My conclusion after several years of really wrestling with this issue is that these are relational concepts. They define each other. So it is not that, religion and spirituality are two separate things. You know, I have a cup of white wine, I have a cup of red wine. They are different. They are, in fact, part of the same, what has been called by sociologists, spiritual milieu. It is all about the engagement with the sacred, with the supernatural, with the divine, whatever term you might wish to use. And in certain societies, we privilege a certain form of engagement, such as a monotheistic religious identity, that comes with a membership, that comes with doctrine or dogma. And in other societies, we privilege the more diffused form of engagement. So I've talked to people who actually have very spiritual practices, engage in rituals, in different religious traditions in China. They follow different religious ethics, but they don't think of themselves as quote-unquote religious, because in their own mind, to be religious is to be a monotheist. So In other words, to be religious means you are a Christian or you're Muslim. Maybe we're going through a de-reformation, post-reformation period, when we're welcoming a more diverse and pluralistic understanding of how to be religious. And by doing so, we are thinking about spirituality as not something separate from religion, but as simply the most universal form of engaging with the spiritual, with the world of the spirits, with the divine, with the sacred.
What is your definition of wonder?
Wonder to me is to see how humans always seek something beyond this physical, secular world. Wonder to me is to see how creative, how open-hearted, how hopeful, how joyous it is when people try to make a connection with something beyond the secular world in which we have all kinds of extraordinary scientific advancements, knowledge. The wonder to me is people still care so much about religion and spirituality. The wonder to me is how much we care about being with one another in our search for something beyond this world that we are part of.
It's beautiful. What about beauty?
I am so grateful to the beauty of nature. So beauty is, to me, everything in nature. I'm astonished by everything from trees to mushrooms, that as you've shown us, and to flowers, to animals, to the ocean, to rocks. Everything in nature stops me in my tracks. But beauty to me is also how we care about one another, how we care for one another. Beauty to me is how we care about the common good. Beauty to me is how we try to live a moral life under difficult circumstances. Given all of our shortcomings as humans, we strive to be better. To me, that is an absolutely beautiful thing.
Have you ever thought about the fact there's so much art that is brought into temples, churches, beauty, right? Inspired by nature. And maybe maybe they're tapping into a certain like score that the universe created called beauty that orchestrates the dance of life, because nobody teaches anybody what is beautiful. I don't think there's a course at Princeton that teaches people what is beautiful, right? How do we have that inside of us? And why is it used to immerse people into a spiritual experience?
Absolutely. I love the thought of art and rituals are connected. And by the way, that necklace you wear, is that a religious symbol? Is that religious art, if I may ask?
It's somebody gave me at a mushroom festival the necklace, and it's a mushroom, and I've worn it as a superstitious lucky token, but it reminds me, it's just one portal into nature's intelligence, which for me inspires my soul and gives me certain spiritual comfort. It could be a flower. It could be a hummingbird. It could be anything hanging on my neck that reminds me that there are so many different worldviews or into the divine. And nature provides these like portals of journeys into discovery to be able to be immersed into that emotional feeling. And just feeling it might be enough, as opposed to having to define what it is and what's next.
That is beautiful. What you're saying reminds me of this idea in the Confucian tradition that to be moral and to appreciate beauty are connected. Mm-hmm. So beauty isn't just beauty. Beauty also has moral value connected right. to it. Beauty should inspire us to be moral, and someone who is moral is beautiful. And I think beauty in nature, as you've been describing it, should also instill certain values in us, such as right. care, for nature, such as thinking about the connection between beauty and justice. The wonderful critic Eileen Skerry has made that argument that beauty and justice are connected.
Yeah. I think we're hardwired to appreciate beauty, because think about the fact that all kittens are cute and puppies are cute and babies are cute. If they weren't cute, you wouldn't take care of them. And why do you take care of them? Because life wants DNA to go forward. Life wants evolution to evolve. And it isn't like a moral thing, like, oh, I should take care of a child or something young that needs to be nurtured. I think we're hardwired to do it. And I think beauty motivates us without us even realizing it, because it's love. We fall in love. It's unconditional love, right? And nobody, and again, it's another example, nobody is taught that. No parent is taught about unconditional love, right? And we do it unknowingly, which is really beautiful.
Absolutely. And what you're saying reminds me of this famous idea of Mencius, one of the early Confucian thinkers from more than 2,000 years ago, who has this idea that humans are all born moral or good. So he says we're all people born with this four sprouts of virtues. These virtues of benevolence, for example, wisdom, this sprouts of virtues have to be nurtured. And for those of us who fail to nurture these virtues, we lose that beauty of human nature. You can speak of that, I think, as a form of beauty. So human nature is good or beautiful, but we must nurture it for it to remain so, for it to grow, for it to flourish. So I love the thought that beauty is innate, the appreciation of beauty, recognition of beauty is innate to us. But to use this idea from Mencius, we also must protect it. We also must do things to help it grow and flourish.
Beauty is also something that is, you know, used as manipulation for behavior, whether it's marketing or advertising, because it works. And, you know, there's scientific studies that figure out, like, what's the perfect color for a car in a certain country. You know, it's all dialed in very, you know, scientifically accurate, again, to manipulate behavior. But again, beauty was used, I think, to manipulate, which is not a bad word, us to celebrate life, to protect life. And it can also be used to manipulate you to buy a product. So just to be conscious of the power of beauty, to be visually literate, I think, is something that we all need to develop, you know, that skill set, because it's so easy to press that button because we're hardwired to do it.
Absolutely. I think beauty is manipulated all the time for commercial purposes. You know, all the ads we see, most of them are beautiful.
Yeah.
And as you said, you know, perfectly calibrated to elicit that feeling in us to say, wow, this is beautiful. Well, I wish I could have that car.
Well, I used to do commercials, and all I can tell you is we hire the most talented, expensive artists to do everything from lighting to costume design to set design, who are extraordinary in their field, because, you know, money doesn't matter when you're making a commercial. You know, it's only a 3-day shoot or a 2-day shoot. But I always admired, like, the opportunity to work with these brilliant artists. You know, unfortunately, we were doing things that were the end result, or the goal is to get someone to buy a product, whatever that product was. But another example to be aware that a tremendous amount of energy, talent, money, focus goes into manipulation of your behavior using beauty. You know, that's the main tool they use to engage your emotions, to engage your senses in order to motivate a certain type of behavioral reaction.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think that's one of the real dangers of 21st century life. I've been learning about, you know, how data can be weaponized, how responses on digital platforms can be used to manipulate us, and our receptiveness to beauty, as you said, is one of our greatest strengths and weaknesses because it's so easily manipulable. And I think this is where religious ethics are so important, because religious ethics, such as the Confucian one — I'm speaking of the Confucian one because it's very close to my heart — but many, I think all other religious ethics would speak the same, perhaps in different ways, which is that we must take virtue seriously. We must think beyond the surface of beauty to find that root of beauty. So when we see, you know, the beauty of the flower, of the mushroom, we also know there's something much deeper than what we're seeing. There's this whole mechanism of organism in full flourishing. There's something underneath the image. That's what the beauty of nature really is. It's what's beneath the breathtaking image of of beauty. And that's what we're trying to protect.
And just, Andy, really quickly, what's the definition of virtue?
A set of dispositions, habits that we embody that value things such as compassion, love, care, and concern for the common good. So virtue isn't just a belief. It has to be embodied. It has to be expressed in everyday life.
So I hope you don't think I'm an annoying five-year-old kid who keeps on asking you to define things that are like very basic, but I would love to hear your definition of gratitude.
By the way, I love those questions because I think thinking about those fundamental concepts is so important to intellectual clarity. So yeah. I appreciate that. Gratitude is to acknowledge that whatever life you're having that makes you happy is not something that comes from you and your actions alone. So gratitude means we acknowledge and express our sense that the good fortunes we may have, being alive is a great good fortune for one, and being able to see beauty is another. This most fundamental good fortunes we have may come from somewhere else, from other people, or perhaps from a divine source, or from tradition. I think I'm immensely grateful for other people, but also for tradition, for other people in the past. I feel, for example, when I read a good book written 50 years ago or 500 years ago, I feel immense gratitude.
I want to thank you for this incredible conversation. I want to thank the Fetzer Institute for introducing us and to supporting this podcast, and Sarah and Sam and Courtney and Annie for helping me make it happen.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed this conversation tremendously. And what a pleasure it is to spend this hour talking about wonder and beauty and gratitude. I'm full of gratitude. Thank you so much, Louis.
Thank you.